Welcome to Ever Beyond, 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 on Wolf Spirit Radio, Ever Beyond Radio, and Tir na Sao in Ireland. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, beyond, beyond. Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon. Let me grab the right mouse so I can see. Yes, indeed. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to Ever Beyond. It's the 25th of October 2015, or 25102015. Yeah, it's not quite palindromic, but there's lots of numbers in there. Look, it's 1502 on 25102015. Well, there you go. Welcome, everybody. I don't know what's going to happen today. It's a fifth ray day, the day for lots of kind of nitty gritty, down to the metal kind of scrape off the last bits of paint and see what's underneath kind of days. I've certainly had a very odd mood today, and I don't know what it is. So, having had a shower and, maybe I need to get into this appropriate mood to get into the subject which I want to talk to you about. So tonight, my guest, at least for the moment, while I can grab hold of her, because I know you sometimes have a visitor, but if you would like to join me for a little while, Nancy Hopkins, good afternoon, how are you?
Very good, Jay. Thank you for having me. So, you know, we love the subject.
Yeah, we do. I mean, you basically triggered me off the other about 20 minutes ago, and you were starting to talk about nuclear power stations and how they all related to the Nazis. And then I thought, that's interesting. And then you spoke about Bohemian Grove, and I thought, And as you did all this research, and there's all these CEOs and people who worked for Bechtel turning out to be like very Germanic. In fact, haven't you noticed, Nancy, that a lot of CEOs have German names? In general, CEOs in general have these kind of long names. Interesting, isn't it?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I don't study CEOs, but...
Mark Zuckerberg?
But there is a lot of... Yes, there is a lot of German names that seem to be in the threshold of the higher echelons of our economy and of our industry. And, you know, was there that many... I mean, there's a percentage of how many Germans came over, you know? And if you look at that, I don't think that it would make sense that you have that many German in the high one percenters compared to, any other nationality. And I don't know that anybody's ever studied that as a percentage, that it goes against just the odds. But yes, the more I've looked at it, the more I'm convinced that's the way it happened.
Okay. Let's put a few more peas in the pot. All right. This is information, and I think you've gotten a lot of information from the same people, which is David Hawkins and Field McConnell at abledanger.net. And one of the things they spoke about a long time ago, you know, he talks about so many things, and it's amazing to listen to him, and you know, it's like months of research, all in an hour or so. But anyway, he spoke about when Project Paperclip started. What they did was to bring them over to northern Scotland, a place called Caithness, and there's an army camp there. And yes, indeed, if you look at the local telephone directory in Caithness, you'll see lots of German names. And this was the place where I believe they did the Clockwork Orange thing. You saw the film Clockwork Orange, didn't you?
Oh yeah, but I wouldn't know what it's about now.
All right, well, there is a very memorable scene. I'm sure you remember it because it burns my eyes. The part where he's shown the violence that he did to other people. He's shown films, and they force him with his eyes open to look at this thing. You remember that bit?
No, but I found that movie very disturbing.
Totally, yeah, I mean, it is a disturbing movie, but I think there's a lot of shaded reference to the Nazis in that movie. And one of the things that happened, and now this is like Hawkins stuff plus a bit of my conjecture, which is that they forced them to look at films of what the Nazis did, and some of them got turned on by it, and some of them were horrified by it, and that probably produced two grades of former Nazi. I mean, there was one that was truly a former Nazi, and then there was a former Nazi in name only, and I believe that probably filtered them into different organizations, and probably the ones that were turned on went into the black operations, and the others were like released into the world as corporate executives to build corporations for their hybrid children who would later on come along like Mark Zuckerberg and you know, hold these corporations. And basically the corporate world is the Nazi International. That's what it is. There's no difference. And that's why the new world order and the corporate world and the media and all of these things that we find ourselves surrounded by are all the product. That is, you know, like you say just now, the Nazis did not lose the war.
Well, did you see Corey Good's most recent post?
I haven't seen that. No.
I posted it on your YouTube, your Facebook page. It was interesting to me because I've never really listened. I think maybe a couple of times to Abel Danger. What I knew about this was deep research that I did early in the game before a lot of people even conceived of it, because of where I was in the government and the intelligence world, and because of what I was being led to see. Books would show up, magazines would show up, somebody would say something to me. You know, I mean, it's almost like somebody's there trying to get me the information that I need to understand. Oh my God, we never won the war. And when I was working with you, when we were talking about Sean David Morton's book, Sands of Time, and that was twinging a whole bunch of stuff in me, and then my intuitive side started to kick in. And what I realized was that they were so close to so many different things, and yet they didn't seem to... It was almost like they would get close, and then it would disappear. And in intelligence work, that indicates that somebody has got a working model of it, and now it's gone into deep secret. And I got suspicious by the way that the story was going concerning the secret weapons and the technology and all, that the people that had it now had a God complex of, well, we don't even need to win this war. This war is not even important to us. We have the keys to a new breakaway civilization. And so I anticipated that that was where all these 20,000 people went, was they just sort of said, you go fight that little war, you little peons. We're going to go do our own thing. And when this report came out with Wilcox and Good, he was going through it, and he was explaining it just like I had seen it. That in fact they realized that they had, you know, the keys to control that Hitler would have loved, but they didn't even need Hitler at that point. They didn't need any of them, and so they set off. They broke away from Nazi Germany. And they became their own little world, their own little nation. And he also, I had been suspicious from a very long time that the overflying 52 of Washington by these UFOs was not extraterrestrial. It made no sense to me.
Yes. You know, and he, yeah, you're right. Go on. And he?
Well, but he confirmed that that was the Nazis' overt threat to the American government, Truman in particular, that if they didn't sign the truce treaty between themselves, the Nazis, and the U.S. government, that what would happen is that they would do a mock exposure of ETs that would freak out the entire world and everybody would go into mass panic and then they would win again anyway. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, that was perfect. Thank you. So,
I mean, there's that book out there that I thought when I first mm-hmm. heard about it
cool.
was kind of nutty. The one, and I don't remember her name, I did not read the book, but she was claiming that the crash in Roswell was Nazis. That it was actually a Nazi vehicle that crashed there. And I don't know whether it's true or not, but she got a lot of flack for it, and when somebody gets a lot of flack, I pay attention to what they might be saying.
Exactly. So this is, I mean, this is putting our last 70 years of history. Now, we know that there's a PSYOP. I think we don't know how big it is. And I think we're just now starting to look at the edge and peel up the little plastic cover that is holding it all down. So let's just roll back a little bit more here. So, you know, I used to think, oh, yes, ETs, flying saucers, yeah, okay. Obviously, I was a kid, I'd fallen for the memes, you know. And now, here I am, looking back on it all, and, you know, everything that was extraterrestrial, I'm now thinking, maybe it wasn't extraterrestrial completely. I'm still very much a firm kind of knower. Not believer, but knower that we are not alone, you know, that we're not even from here, so, you know, what are we complaining about? So now, you know, I'm looking back. I had a girlfriend. Before I was out with Nikki, I was out with a girlfriend, and she was very, very skeptical, very bright, but very skeptical, and she said, no, they're ours, you know, they're all ours. She was insisting, you know, that there were no aliens at all. So, I had to sort of argue the position. But now I'm coming across and thinking, well, maybe she had a point at some, on some levels that not exactly ours, because as you say, there's a Nazi breakaway civilization that basically dumped Hitler with the Catholics. And he went through, became ordained, became Father Crespi, and Martin Bormann did the same, and they were shipped off to Argentina, where the Perón, my namesake, was very friendly, as Walters explained in his reports. And that was fascinating to hear Walt talk about Argentina when he was a kid, because that is a place where this is where the Nazis went. So that's why it was like that. That's why, you know, so Walter's grown up under a Nazi regime, you know. And everybody here on this planet, we're all under a Nazi regime. And it's now starting to, you know, the edges are starting to seal together, or they're trying to. And this is, at this point, this is where we can, not quite put our foots in the door because they're made of iron, but we can put something in there that may trip, because it's a very cleverly organized mechanism. It's a great big iron machine, and what can you do with a simple clog? Do you know the word clog? You know, the footwear is also the name for when a machine is not working. It's because they used to throw their clogs into the machinery to stop them working. And a clog...
That's funny.
And a clog in French is the word sabot. So somebody who threw their clog, their sabot, into the machine is a saboteur. That's where the word saboteur comes from.
Well, yes, Walt's stories of Argentina give you kind of a spooky kind of understanding of where we're going or where they would like us to go. Because as a child, he knew that there was this evil, but he was basically didn't confront it. You know, on the one hand, he would say, well, one time some cop asked me to, you know, show my identification, but that's as close as he came to being, you know, having an encounter with the authorities. But in a very kind of like off-the-cuff remark, he said, of course, there were all those thousands of people in those thousands of graves. You know, so, I remember when he said it to me, he said it on the air, we were talking
about
something.
That's stark, isn't it? That is so stark.
I know, and I don't think I didn't stop him. I didn't even want to confront what he had just said, you know? And maybe someday I'll come across that particular tape but it was so nonchalant that I was like, whoa. I mean, I know that in Walt, I know, that he understood the impact of it, but he was sort of talking from the memory of a child. And, yeah. You know, so that was what I found to be spooky, is that at a very young age, he was already conditioned to the concept of thousands of dead people and thousands of graves. You know, and that was frightening to me, because I think that is being completely perfected in our today because of the video games.
Yeah, they're numb to violence, and yet so sensitive to sex. You know, when I remember, you know, sitting with my son, you know, and he's now 19, he'll be 20 soon, you know, I was looking away when there's all that violence and people being sawn up and he's sitting there, and as soon as the hero kissed the girl, he looked away. You know, it's like, oh my God, there's something wrong here. You know, this is our generation. We were the peace and love generation. Theirs is the generation. So it's
almost like they practiced in Germany.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then
exactly.
They went to Argentina, and they had it finessed a little more,
yep.
So that it wasn't like strutting in the streets.
Yep.
It was strutting in your mind. Because, like I say, to Walt, he didn't see a presence, and yet he knew. And so I think that now they have gotten into the secrecy so much that it's permeating every single thing around us, and we're not even aware that this is fascist.
Yeah.
And you know, people, okay. The definition of democracy is all for one. The definition for communism is one for all. And the definition of fascism is one for the state. And that's where we're at.
Yeah, and you could even say, Nancy, you could even say that corporation is the same as state.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah. and that, yes, because there is no state anymore. It's corporation. The United States is owned and operated by a corporation. I don't want to get into it, but that just accept that as being a fact, and if you do, then you'll be okay with the rest of the conversation. Because if you understand that this is all being perpetrated against us by a group of people who think that they are godlike, and for comparisons, they sort of are godlike. I will say this about, I want to go back to the concept of whether there are ETs or not. I'll give you one little segment, and that was when I was at the University of Massachusetts. I was a freshman. And I was explaining I was telling UFO stories. I just had a slew of them since I was a
freshman. Really, Nancy? You wouldn't be sitting around telling you. Sorry.
No, seriously, this was the strangest thing. Because when I was a freshman in high school, we had an English teacher who wanted to teach debate, and some wise ass said, well, let's debate about UFOs. And she said, oh, well, okay. And she said, who will be for UFOs? And nobody raised their hand, but I really liked her. She was a friend of my mother's. So I raised my hand. I had no idea of any of this, right? But when I started researching it, it was like overwhelming. And so when I go to do this debate, I get up and I give my opening statement. And what's his name? LaCroix was his last name. What was his first name? He was cute. I had a crush on him. But anyway, he wouldn't even debate me because there was nothing he could say. I mean, he was basically going to say, well, that's crazy that anybody would think that, right? And here I've got all these facts that I laid out. So from the time I was a freshman in high school to when I was a freshman in the university, I had spent 4 years really investigating this. And I was telling these stories, you know, oh, da, 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 da. And then I went off and I did some homework. And then I came back and it was late at night and this room, it was actually funny because I was Nancy, but these people living next door to me was Nancy and Nancy. So we had Nancy, me, and Big Nancy, and Little Nancy. And so I stopped in there and I said to them, well, good night, have a good night. And Big Nancy was already in the bunk on the top and she had the curtain was pushed just to the side a little bit. And she says to us, you guys aren't going to believe this, but there's a UFO outside the window. Now, this is 2 hours after I told them all these stories, so we thought she was joking around. And I just went over to the curtain, and I pulled it away, you know, and I was like, yeah, right. And all of a sudden, like, I'm looking at a UFO. And I said a lot of bad words, Jay, a lot of bad words. I was like, you know. And, of course, my reaction got Little Nancy to jump up, and so the three of us are looking at this thing. And we were at the third floor of a dormitory, and right across from us, oh, probably 300-400 yards, was a dining facility. And that was two stories. And right coming so that you could look over the top of the dining facility was this apparently circular, because you couldn't see the outline. The only thing you could see was this red light that was whizzing around the edges of it. And I mean, it was big. It was not huge, but it was probably, well, by the time it got just to the dining room, to the dining facility, apparently, you know, I mean, because you're at night and your eyes are doing weird things on you and you're seeing something and you're saying a lot of bad words and screaming. So this thing got to there, and then it just sort of like was probably half the size of the building. And it looked like it was going to fly right into where we were, but did we do anything except saying bad words and screaming? No. And then all of a sudden it just went, whoosh, and disappeared.
Ooh.
And that, a few weeks after that, now I don't think it was weeks, I think it was days, I was in the, down the hall and I was in the study room, and all of a sudden I got this weird feeling. And I said to my roommate, I said, Jesus, I got a weird feeling. She said, what do you mean? I said, I don't know. I've had this before. When did I have this before? And all of a sudden I realized that just before I went in to say goodnight to them, I had had that same feeling. So I said, there's another one out there. And I knew exactly where it was in the sky. And I ran out of the building and had to go down three stories to get outside. And I look up exactly where it is. And my friend just had taken off and followed me. And I'm looking at this. Now, this is just a big white light. And a big white light. Let's say to my eye, it was maybe the size of about 3 millimeters. I mean, 6 millimeter bead. Not very big, but in the sky, it's pretty big. And so I'm like, I get like this feeling that I've got some kind of communication, some kind of a link with these guys. And so I said, go to the right. And the thing went to the right. Go to the left. Went to the left. And that is the only thing I remember. After that, I remember nothing. The next thing I remember, I was back in the study room, and my friend was sitting there with me. And I don't ever remember having a conversation directly about that. So I don't know whether there's missing time or it just overwhelmed my 3D brain. I'm not sure. But then, like a week after that or so, we're walking across the field, and it was just this open field. And we were on our way to the local college theater to see a movie. And there were three people in front of us, and then there was myself and, again, my roommate. And we were maybe, I don't know, 10 yards behind him. And all of a sudden I said, oh, geez. I said, there's another one. And I turned around and I looked, because I got the feeling. I turned around, I looked, and here comes this circular vehicle, the size of a house, almost on top of us, with the red spinning lights going around it. And it flies over us, probably maybe, it wouldn't have been more than four stories above us. And silent, not a sound. And and then it gets in the view of the people that are in front of us, and they all stop dead in their tracks. And we watch this thing, and I say it probably went out about a mile, and then it did a 90-degree turn. And then it went up down about a mile and a half, and I know that by then it was over the little town of Amherst. And then it made another 90-degree turn. And it's going now the back from where it started, you know, going the other direction, and it stopped. And all of a sudden, there was another red little vehicle. It looked smaller, much smaller, and it came up into this, it like seemed to come from the ground up into the to the vehicle that had flown over us. But while this was happening, I saw in the distance what obviously to me was a jet airplane. I could see the lights coming directly at it. And this jet was almost on top of it before that thing went zoop, gone, disappeared. So in those instances, I feel that there was some kind of a telepathic communication between me and whoever was on those vehicles. So flash forward to the springtime, and we were, no, it wasn't, it was just before intercession. So, no, it was just before Christmas. It was still in the winter, it was just before Christmas. We were, I'm in the same, almost in the same room that I had been in the first time, except now I'm on the fourth floor. And, but over that same room. And we had just come back from the dining facility. We're in the room, and this one friend of ours goes, "Starlight, star bright, for, oh my God, what is that?" And so we all look out the window, and I see this light that is like a diamond just sitting there. And I mean, big. To my eye, distance I don't know, but to my eye, it was at least a 6 inches big. And it just started rotating. And all of a sudden, we're watching it now, and it goes right in front of us, and it was now above us. It was at the 19th floor. Now, why do I know it's the 19th floor? Because it turned out that I had friends who were in a tower. Now, our little four-floor dormitory to the just to the, if we're looking out the window, just to the left of us were two 20-story towers, dormitory towers. And this thing flew between these two towers. And at the 19th floor, there was it was a lounge. And there were people on the balcony when this thing went by them. They said that they could have reached out and touched it. Now, I believe now that I know about the breakaway civilization, that that was not an ET ship. First off, when Randy Kramer. When Randy Kramer described getting on the vehicle that took him to the moon, he described it, and I saw that image in my head. Because what I saw was there was a body to it, but then it had like delta wings. You know, these wings that came out, very short compared to the body. And the other thing that I think I saw that didn't make any sense to me at the time, but does now after hearing Kramer's story, it looked like there were portals, like there were little windows in it. And the other thing that I had not detected in any of the others, I did not detect any sound or vibration coming from those others. But this thing, I could hear a hum. I was aware that I was hearing a hum, and I was feeling some kind of vibration on my body. And like I say, to me, this was not an ET ship. This was one of the breakaway civilizations.
Made of nuts and bolts.
Yeah. Yeah. But the interesting thing was that in intercession, my roommate and I happened to not go home. We just decided we were going to vacation in the area and go around the local area. And she had a letter come at that time from her boyfriend, and he lived up in Buffalo. And in it, he had a clip from the Buffalo newspaper that said that it was a whole story about this UFO that had been seen at the University of Massachusetts. Now, we had seen none of this in the local papers, but in Buffalo, they did. And what it said was see, there is a Springfield's not very far from Amherst, and there's Westover Air Force Base that's located there. And this report said that the Westover Air Force Base, and at the time I didn't get it, but now I do, there was no conventional aircraft in the area at the time.
Yeah, right. No conventional. Anyhow, so that brings us to the subject of the Hanabu and the various other designs of literally German UFOs, you know, flying discs that were powered by various forms. There was like an electrostatic form. And from the book Die Glocke, it had the secret was given to them by an extraterrestrial group that claimed to be from Aldebaran. And the being called himself, I think, Alquan or something. Alien sounding name, Alquan or something. And he described a metal as a ferrofluid, a ferromagnetic fluid. That's what they were looking for. It was only now. Who was it that brought the two together? I think it was Martin Bormann, who was in charge of both the Glock project and the other project, which was the production of the Red Mercury, or the production of various fuels that they were looking for. This is a guy called Werner Eckert, and he tried lots of things, and he murdered probably hundreds of thousands of slave Jews, he used to throw them into a room with the purple ray in it, which was produced by red mercury when you energize it, and they would turn into black mush. It was horrible. I mean, it was just like every nightmare film that has been made about mad Nazi scientists, that was Werner Eckert. Anyway, he's the guy who came up with Serum 525, which is what we call red mercury. And he said, well, how much have you got? And he said, oh, well, I've got about like half a gram. And he said, we need 2 tons per machine. And so they built bigger facilities, and they used an entire power station. They would run it overnight, and they'd use the entire energy of the power station running overnight to produce. They had to boil thorium in mercury to produce, plus another bunch of other things, to produce this. Basically, because mercury, you can't move it with a magnet, and that's the thing. If you can move mercury with a magnet, then it would work. So they make it magnetic by adding, finely divided iron, and then they spin it very fast. And that's what makes that sound of a UFO, or these purported UFOs. When you put the you have 2 cylinders of these things counter rotating, so one's going clockwise, the other one's going anti-clockwise, and they do it really fast. At some point, the opposing magnetic fields cause a twist in space-time. They call it a Z-point. The magnetic fields are spinning so far so fast in operation that it can't be made, and it tears a hole and it opens it up like an iris. And that is the thing. Yeah, interesting, eh? Hang on a second. That is the thing that opens up the space-time portal. And it either goes through it itself, as it did when it escaped from Castle Kyaz and arrived in Kecksburg, or it would open up a portal, and then another ship which was sitting underneath it would then up through it. And that would take them to Aldebaran. And that was the idea of what the Glocke did. It opened up a portal. I think it was, maybe it was above the thing. Maybe it opened a portal above the thing. And it was like a kind of impeller in space-time that would sit at the bottom of a great big vortex that once it fired up. And it was it was chained to a great big hinge. That's what they find in the old sort of war archaeology films, it's got these henges all over the thing, and they had these ideas of what they were for, but basically they would chain the Glocker to it because they were enormous titanium chains.
Corey Good claimed that they were being used as the propulsion unit in a craft.
Yes.
That it wasn't itself some type of transportation thing. It was actually the propulsion unit.
Yeah. But it in itself, it was able, it worked by itself because that's how they escaped. And they escaped and they were picked up by a guy who was in Project Paperclip. And this is, it's part of the conversation I'm having with Sean, because he knows about the Project Paperclip, and the guy who wrote the book that I read, which is Die Glocke, the guy whose journals that was, is now known, or was then known, as Wolf Davis. We've actually got a name that links him with him, and he was the only survivor of the Bell Project. And he knew the Bell because he'd worked on it, but it was 20 years ago, and it was still fresh from the day that he'd been working on it. And his boss was in it.
You mean the one that ended up, it was supposedly UFO, but it was actually Bell that it ended up in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's right. And it ended up at Wright-Patterson, I think. I think that's the one.
Right.
And they had to get these special tiles in order to contain, what might happen if the red mercury exploded. Because what happens is that red mercury is an accelerant. If you have a ton of TNT and you have a drop of red mercury with it, it becomes like 100 tons of TNT. It just accelerates every everything that is evil, it will accelerate. Basically, it's just kind of rampant stuff. So, but it's one of these things. Now, the thing is, so that's one little thread. This is the Nazi access to essentially a free form of energy, because once you kick these things kick these things going, they're kind of self-sustaining, they fuel themselves because they produce a vast amount of energy, and you can tap some of it back to just keep the motor running, so it's essentially like one of these over unity devices, but really over unity. But you have to, and this is you might understand some of the physics behind this, I was talking about this. We were talking about colloidal gold and colloidal silver. I know this sounds like completely off the wall, but it's about metallurgy and alchemy and all of that stuff. Is that gold has a pattern? And I was talking with Nikki Wolf Baby and my friend Dean, who's the concrete expert. He's an expert in lime and concrete and crystallizations and all that stuff. So we had a great little brainstorm last night. But we're talking about gold being the template upon which DNA can kind of organize itself. And mercury is the only thing that can wet gold. And it's almost like it's the anti-gold. It's the opposite of gold. It's the destructive force that gold is the constructive force of. And so they would...
You said that mercury wet gold, got it wet?
Yeah.
So the gold is absorbing it?
Yeah, if you put your gold pen nib in mercury, it will kind of put holes in it. They use mercury to...
Just regular mercury.
Yeah, regular mercury, not the red mercury. Mercury is a really kind of highly reactive, not corrosive. Well, it's corrosive to your nervous system. I mean, if you look at, you can look at YouTube, mercury, what did I say? Mercury, nerve ending. Just type in Mercury and Nerve Ending into YouTube, and you'll see a film of a drop of mercury, a tiny amount of mercury, and the nerve literally running away from it, receding, retracting away from a piece of mercury that is placed near it. It's deadly. It's highly, highly toxic.
So that we know that mercury affects the nervous system. So
That's how it does it.
It's because the nervous system is actually screwing itself up trying to get away from it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Wow. And that's why if you can get the mercury out of your system, your nervous system comes back.
Yeah. Simple. It's really simple. You know, all these things that are, the doctor says this and doctor. No, you've got poisoning. And you've got poisoning from something the doctor doesn't want to admit to. Because he's paid by the company who makes the shit.
Oh yeah, I mean the mercury in the dental fillings.
Mm.
Randy Wheeler, who was on earlier, the first show we heard him, he was talking about the dentist saying, "Well, I can't tell you that the mercury in your fillings is killing you, but I can tell you that you need your fillings replaced."
Exactly.
You know, in other words, legally, he can't say that that's why I want to replace your fillings, but I can tell you to replace your fillings. I just can't tell you why I'm telling you that. Because they have to sign a contract with the American
with
Dental
the
Association.
With the devil.
Yeah.
American Devil Association.
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
Wow. Yeah, I know.
That's very interesting.
You know, this is heavy shit. And this is what the Nazis have put in our water. You know, they're literally poisoning us from the air, from the from what we eat, from the sea. Now, so here's the thing: maybe they don't care about this planet because they found others. Maybe they don't care about dominating the world because they found somewhere else to go.
Yeah, but why are they spending all this time trying to kill us? They want us out of here, or they want us under control. I think it's more of they want us under control.
Well, because we know who they are, and we can point them out and say, look, you might appear really perfect, you guys, but actually, look what's happening back here. And this is exactly the same story as Aldebaran. That's what they did on Aldebaran. That's exactly what they did on Aldebaran. They committed the imperfect part of their population to another planet on the other side of the sun just before it went supernova without space travel, and basically, you know, left them to it. And that's what they're like, and this is what they're doing here, you know. And this is a modus operandi, and this is what Alex Collier talked about. 800 years in the future, this disease has spread throughout the galaxy. It's like mercury and the nervous system. So that is the tyranny. This is the tyranny that Alex Collier has been talking about. It's the corporate world that we can't even see. It's so big, the lie is so big, we can't see it. It makes no sound.
Well, it doesn't make any common sense. I mean, that it's so difficult to try to explain to somebody, you know. It was all the chemtrails. Let's go back to the chemtrail thing for a minute, because that was a very interesting post. Out of all of the things I've ever reposted, the chemtrail post I did yesterday got many, many more likes, many more comments, because the difference between a lot of the stuff that we're saying and chemtrails is the truth is up there. Just look up. It's there. You can see it. Everybody in the world can look up and see that there is this bizarre crisscrossing of lines that people say, oh, it's contrails. No, it's not a contrail. A contrail is short duration. These are long lines of crap up there. Now, why? Well, don't you want to know what it is all about? And what the posting was about was a guy that is U.S. military Air Force pilot, and he's flying these things. And it was brilliant to be able to perceive what's in the minds of the people that are flying these, obviously putting stuff into the atmosphere. And he said that they are shown movies, videos of what will happen if they don't do this, because this is national security. We're being protected against exotic weapons that the Russians and the Chinese are supposed to have, and so they're shown this terrible devastation if they don't do this, and that they're kept, it's kept secret from them to protect them, and all of the mind control stories that they tell these people to do in order to get them to do this. And he said that the people that are chosen for this particular job are really the top echelon of the Air Force pilots. But I think what he meant were they were the top echelon of controllable pilots. Cause I'll go back to that thing you said about Scotland, and I think you said Scotland.
Yes.
Where they, yeah, okay. And you think that maybe they had testing and it said, well, this is a real Nazi, cause they didn't freak out when they saw it. They got off on the devastation. And these are the guys that, well, maybe we can still control them. And,
yes,
I think
useful
that,
idiots.
Yeah, well, what I found correlating with that is his statement that he felt that the, first off, that 80% of those pilots do not have a family. They're not married. They don't have children. And that he felt that they were, had no connection to humanity at all. They, no emotional, you know, oh yeah, humanity, I love it. You know, none of that. And that he really considered them to be almost robotic. He did not use that word, but he inclinated that that's what it, where he was going with it. And so it goes back to what you're saying, is that the stuff that's being done to us is being done by people who, let's face it, there's something really screwy about them. And we can't get our head around it because we wouldn't be that screwy ourselves. We can't really get our head around what the heck is with these pedophiles, because it's nothing that we would understand. It's not part of our experience. And that's what is working against us, is that we will not allow our imagination to understand pure evil. And that's the only way I can think of it, because there's no explanation for why some of these people are doing the things that they're doing, except that they're disconnected from an emotional component to human beings, to Earth herself. So are they robotic? Have they been so mind-controlled that they're zombies? These are the things that we're confronting now.
Well, here's the thing.
Because now we know the problems.
Yeah, but you know, in as well as these purple light, which is basically ultraviolet C, you know, they're exposing Jews to ultraviolet C to kill them. They also did other experiments, and one of the files that has been, you know, dug up, that nobody wants to look at, is what's known as reanimating flesh, which is zombie. Is that the Nazis were actually working on being able to control this disanimate bodies. So basically taking dead people and turning them into robots. Yeah. They thought of shit like this.
Well, you talk about recycling. Now
yeah,
that's recycling.
That's recycling taken to the nth degree. But it's okay, you can blow them away and have fun. No, because that's what all the movies are about. Ah! You know. It's... So, Nancy, let's get to where we want to go to. Because this... Let's bring it up to date. A couple of nights ago, I watched Sarah Adams and Max Spears' bases demonstration. Have you seen that one?
No.
No. Okay, doesn't matter. But there's this whole thing about the black goo, the good black goo and the bad black goo, and the bad black goo is the blue black goo, right, okay. And then we have Shanghai, and then we have the Schwarzenstein, right? And the Schwarzenstein means the black stone, and it's the Schwarzenstein of the Brotherhood of the Black Stone, the DHS, which is the, what is it, DHVSS, you know, the Brotherhood of the Schwarz of Black Stone, right? And it's something to do with a stone that was retrieved from a very dark kind of mountain somewhere in eastern Germany. Have you heard anything about this?
No, nothing.
Right. Okay, so now here's the other thing. Okay, so now I'm going to bring in another thread of Wolf Spirit Radio. And it's been something that's been happening for the last 20 weeks. That Jessica, on a Thursday, has been relaying a communication she's been having with a man who claims to be from the Andromedan Galaxy. And they were from a essentially a slave race, or a race that had been enslaved, and had released themselves from it. And partly due to the connection that he had with Jessica. It's a long story. It's like a TV series. It's like a whole sci-fi series. Every release has got new elements and characters in it. And what it turns out to be is like an account from a very, very long time ago. And the time period is getting closer and closer. So some of the things they were talking about were things that happened, say, maybe hundreds of thousands of years ago in our time frame. And then the next one would be, you know, tens of thousands of lifetime of years ago, and things like that. So the time, each episode covers much time. And because these beings live a long time, because they come from a planet where the cycles of sunlight are, you know, longer. Goes to show. So, essentially, they meet up with these different people, and one of these groups of beings that they've been meeting up were, they said that they were a kind of reptilian type race, and they called themselves Catriton. And that, throughout the years, they kind of became friends, and he discovered something about them, is that these Catritons had a black stone implanted at the base of their neck. Yeah, so they had a black stone implanted at the base of their neck. Now, this stone was discovered by one of their number, K-something. They're all called K-something. Kerfuffle, you know. Knadler. One of them discovered this black material, this black stone on a planet, and the stone was a telepathic amplifier, and it took on the programming of whoever discovers it, you know, whoever's there to imprint it, boom, it's theirs. And he was a very warlike and angry man, person. And what he was looking for was, as many military people have in the last 50, 60, 70 years, is a way of communicating with their soldiers on the battlefield. Just like the Indian chief has a series of feathers in a headdress, each of the braves has a single feather. I don't know if anybody's ever got this, but it's the same thing. It's a telepathic communication. They will have long hair with feathers in them. It's a technology, people. Anyway, so this was a technology that he thought that he could use to communicate with his soldiers. And so he created this black stone implant that went at the back of everybody's necks. Except that it had his imprint, which is basically malign and, you know, not very nice. Malign and generally not very pleasant. And so, I believe that the Kaaba stone is one of those stones. It's the stone that was connected to the Titans before they became rogue, because when they took these stones out of their necks, they went rogue. They no longer followed orders. So And you know, this is unfolding as we think. Go ahead.
Time frame. What time frame are we talking here?
Well, I'm not really sure because time is different. I mean, he gives all these numbers and sector things, and I'm sure it's a kind of time, space, frequency coordinate that he's giving us.
But I mean, before Atlantis, after Atlantis, before.
I think probably. I'm inclined to say before Atlantis, or indeed they could be part of the group that formed Atlantis. All right, so here's another one, right? One of them is called Catriton, right? And Catriton, they all went for a stopover at Neptune, which is a planet who apparently was a very pleasurable planet. It was a kind of like, you know, when they go in Star Trek, you know, and they go for an away mission, and there's this planet, and they got all that, you know, the mysterious windy music they have, and then the sparkly sounds, and then this beautiful green woman comes out, right? And you know, she just wants to give you pleasure. That's all, you know. That's all the Neptune girls are for, you know. And I think the Titans, having missed women for quite a long while, had quite a good time there, and one of them decided that he'll own the planet. And everybody became his child or wife, you know, depending. So this became Triton of Neptune, and he was one of the Titans. And they all gave Andronicus these stones, right? They gave him a whole pile of them. Now, Andronicus had already had a pretty serious communication with a piece of this stone, and it was really intense for him, and it was like, oh, he could feel it kind of taking over, you know, it was like a nanobot technology kind of thing. So he could feel it, and anyway, so they all at some point decided to, you know, chuck their stones in. They didn't want to be part of the greater collective anymore. And they gave all the stones to Andronicus, who didn't know what the heck to do with them. And whatever possessed his mind to dump them in the sea in Neptune, which wasn't a good idea, because you know the Neptune is alive, and the sea, and you know it formed out of the sea darkness. You know it caught. You know this is. It's what my teacher used to call cosmic astral evil. And I believe that the Schwarzstein is a piece of that. That's where I'm getting to. Have you followed me? This is really complicated, I know, but have you followed me?
I actually have followed you, I think. Go on.
So yeah, so this is what's going on in this thread that is a radio show that I'm doing on a Thursday evening, and I'm reading the part of Andronicus, and Andronicus is quite an interesting character. He's a bit, you could imagine he's a bit like maybe Spock, in that way that he's very kind of matter of fact about things. He at the beginning of the certainly at the beginning. Because they had been in a very Nazi society, they'd been in a very controlled society, and they weren't allowed to have emotions, they weren't educated, and they were just known as numbers. You know, they just had a serial number and a barcode on the back of the neck. And one of the things he was saying is that he and others like him have been telepathically sending these images to people on Earth in order that films and books may be made about them so that they can be warned. So here's the thing. Here's how my reading of Andronicus has helped me in one of my journeys. He spoke about these Catritons, right? Who are essentially a reptilian humanoid, tall, probably tall whites, what we'd call tall whites, and they have a tendency that when they meet somebody for the first time, they're really, you know, they're very gnarly and teeth bared, and yeah, look how strong we are, and you know, don't mess with us kind of thing. But it's all very bravado, and so when Andronicus becomes wise to this, he's like, yeah, what's your problem? And he's very he's not fazed by them. And because he realizes this is what they do, this is what they're like, you know, this, you know, that, like Klingons, you imagine, like Klingons or bikers or something like that. Anyway, or LA biker gangs who play all the Klingons of movies and bad guys. So anyway, they had a we're talking about Andronicus and his connections with these people called the Triton, the Tritons or the Titans, who eventually became the Titans. Okay. And these people who one of them called himself Zeus at one point, and he's gotten hold of time travel, right? Which is why he considers himself the sort of king of the Titans. You know, they've all got like their own thing, and you know they all have their own aspect of evil, but then you know they're not particularly nice people, but you know, there are sort of some characteristics about them that they, you know, that they like. But they have a tendency to own things. That's their attitude. You know, they discovered it, they own it. And so we can see that coming all the way down to our Nazi society. And so I think that the Ubermensch that these people were talking about are the Titans indeed. What do you think of that? And the Titans were originally controlled by the Black Stone.
But do you have a definitive knowledge of what the Black Stone is? I mean, obviously they had a supply of it if they were putting them in the base of people's...
Yes, yeah, it was like a deposit, like Shungite. It was like it's like an evil Shungite, basically. Or it's not, you know, it was just like Shungite, but it was programmed and it was picked up by an evil man being, or being with malintent, and it picked up on that and it concentrated it, and it, you know, just became the epitome of control and domination.
Well, from what we know of Shungite, it cannot be programmed for evil. It can only be programmed for good.
Well, this is a long time ago, so the program might have been rewritten, you know.
Somebody else may have rewritten the Gaia herself, maybe had rewritten it, because, in fact, Shungite won't even turn on if you don't have pure intent.
Mm.
That's why you get people, and some people are just, they're not going to go there with the concept of a sentient mineral that could help you do all these things. And there's people that out there that, maybe if I, you know, they've got evil intent in what they're doing. In both cases, it's not going to turn on. It takes somebody with a pure intent to really get the Shungite working. So, and again, Shungite is in a small area just to the east of Finland. It's like 1,000 kilometers square and goes down, between 200 and 400 feet. So like something hit the earth. It's the only place on the earth that you find Shungite. You'll hear of stuff that has the fullerene in it. There's a Ukrainian mine and one in Kazakhstan, but that's like, 5% fullerene compared to the carbon content of 35 to 60% that you get in Shungite, which is because of the Shunga village that's right there. So, interesting. Very interesting.
Well, there you go. So...
Now, what did they say about the black goo?
All right, so the black goo. So there's this thing, right? And I haven't found out anything of it. I've just got a snifter of it, but I believe this is what connects these two dots, right? That is something to do with the Titans, something to do with the Nazis, something to do with the SS, because, and also possibly something to do with the Kaaba. Now, remember the Kaaba stone was also being used, the field of it was being used to imprison the jinn. Wasn't that true? I'd like to bring Walt in, really. Maybe I'll... Look, shall we play a tune? Let's bring Walt in with his own tune. I made a theme tune for Walt.
You did?
I did. It's called Walt's theme. It's called Missing Time. This is it. Hey, so yes, having
God, you have graphics.
I've invoked Walt with his theme. That tune I made for him. It's in 4/3/2. It's called "Missing Time." It's on my SoundCloud. If anybody's interested, it's just a nice little relaxation of the brain. Walter, good afternoon. Welcome to Ever Beyond Nazi Edition SS. The Schwarze Stein, the black stone, the black goo, the black thing in the back of the neck of the Titans. What is going on?
The graphic you sent me.
I saw the one in the chat room with the the little.
This is going to be interesting for you. This graphic is based on a story written by a German Argentine writer named Hermann Oesterheld. Your alley, Argentine Germans.
Yes, Argentine Germans. There's probably quite a few of them.
Yeah, and he wrote this three-part book called The Eternaut, you know, where an astronaut travels between the stars. The Eternaut travels in eternity because he could actually shift back and forth in time and therefore visit different timelines. So that graphic is from the first part when the Earth, or rather, he's in Buenos Aires, Argentina, gets invaded. It's an alien invasion. And the creatures that are invading are not even doing it of their own free will. They have that thing on the back of the neck. So there you see one of the alien creatures implanting a human that has been seized. And they put that thing on the back of the neck. Isn't that interesting?
That is so interesting. Oh man, I wonder if Jess is around. I'd love to bring her in now. So, did you manage to get any of the Andronica stuff?
I only heard the last show. Oh, I forgot. Hi, Nancy. Thank you for calling me.
Hi, Walt. Glad you could make it.
Excellent. So it's So we started off talking about the Nazis, and then I thought, you know, there's this thing about the black goo, the black stone. There's, you know, the mind control. There's the archons. There's the archonic grid. There's cosmic astral evil. You know, what do you think, Walt? Do you think they're all the same thing? I mean, are we talking all about the same thing, or are there different levels of black gooness?
Well, I think that what we're coming across, it would be nice to put everything in nice little neat boxes and tie them with little bows, but I don't think it's going to work out that way, because what Corey Good speaks of when he talks about these alien groups that have, like, right now there's 22 DNA programs, there are 22 different ideas and programs that are running simultaneously on modifying and enhancing and mixing their DNA with human DNA, and some of these groups, they think that what they're doing is really good for humanity. So by the same token, the same way that you have these programs running simultaneously, some have been running for 300,000 years, some have been running for 5,000 years, we're going to come across these control agendas from different groups. So this group had this, because, for example, let's focus on one where we were involved, and Nancy did a lot of remote viewing on this, on the issue of the archon, where it was something that came to us from the time of Atlantis. There was an etheric AI type of construct, and it was built just for what it's been doing all this time, controlling the masses, and controlling the masses in a specific way, because if you take that part of the equation, you know, it was done around that time, and they implemented and they let it running, and like Nancy says, you know, the people that built it, you know, are dead and gone, but the thing is still doing what they were programmed to do. And you take that, put that here on this little shelf here, and then open up this other page, what Simon Parks said, and he was very specific that the Archon agenda was to herd humanity, human thought, like you herd sheep, in a specific direction, which is to take humanity to this thing that they want, which is the transhumanism, because the Archon by themselves, they cannot incarnate into an organic body, so they would benefit from a cybernetic body. So that's, and that whole little package is just one layer of mind control from one specific group. And I'll think of all the other groups that are out there that have their vested interest to direct humanity in this or that way. As I mentioned before, you know, humans are amazing reality engines. You get a group together to think in a specific way, and poof, instant reality bubble. So we're a very valuable resource. Everybody wants a human. It's like everybody wants a plasma TV. They're great.
So you're saying essentially that, you know, if you give a human a dream, like you say, you know, I'm a generator. If I was given a thought, then that thought would take seed in my mind, and I would build something out of it. Well, that's like humans do, or that we can even believe something into existence, like money, for instance.
That's why I said to you when I read your human design that generators have a strategy, which is to respond to things. They don't need to go out and get life. Life comes to them, and the peak of your power is when you're in a position of responding, not reacting. Either responding to questions, somebody's asking you questions, or responding to a situation or a circumstance. But as long as you're in that mode, that's where you're at the peak of the power. That's what the generator does best. That business of going out and doing things and taking the world by storm, that's for manifestors only, and that's only 8% of the population. So that's why parents shouldn't force their kids to go out there and be a go-getter and be an overachiever. No, that's only applicable to a tiny percentage of the population. The majority of the population is like you, generators. you literally generate the energy that moves the world. That's the Randy Kramer, not Randy Kramer, sorry, Randy Richmond does a very nice explanation when he compares projectors and generators. For example, Nancy's a projector, I'm a projector. Let's say you're a pharaoh and you want this temple built here in this particular part of your reign, of your kingdom or your country. So you would call a projector, the projector would come in, he would study the land, he would study the layout, he would measure, you know, how much weight the soil can take and how big the temple can be and what measurement it should be and what materials. He'll do all that stuff, and then he'll give the pharaoh the information, and then the pharaoh will get the generators to come in and build the thing. That's the way it works. It's the generator that's the muscle of humanity. He's the one putting up the energy to do things, to make things. The projectors are managers. I mean, they can manage people's energy very well, and they know how to put the right person in the right place. And the manifestors, they just go out and initiate action without anybody's intervention, without an invitation, without a question. So human is a very powerful resource. You get, like I said, you get a group of humans. And remember what Simon Parks has said about consciousness and the distinctions he has made when he has he has been asked questions about the subject of emotion and feelings, and how even he has explained that even though the mantis do have feelings, their scope, their range of feeling, of emotion, is smaller than a human when compared to a human. And the reptilians, of course, they have none. You know, like he says, they have no sense of humor. That's why they cannot tolerate the energy of laughter. It's like garlic to a vampire. But in a human, the range is so huge. And like Raoul Ruhu explained, you maybe have better head for dates. I think it was around, was it like 1780 when planet Uranus was discovered by the astronomer Herschel? Was it around, I think it was around that time, end of the 19th century. When that happened, there was a leap in consciousness, an evolutionary leap in consciousness, and from that moment on, people started being born with 9 centers as opposed to 7 centers. And the solar plexus is actually one of those new centers, and in the entire human design body graph, it is the only center that's both a motor and a center of awareness. So here we're mutating into the species that is actually having their emotional energy as a center of awareness, you know, moving away from the head. Because that energy of feeling, that's like the number one ingredient that you need to manifest things and to make a reality. I mean, you can do mental exercises all day long, but if you don't put fuel in the car, it'll never run. And that emotional energy, that feeling, is what gets the ball rolling. That's why when you read the Esther Hicks materials, you know, Abraham, the Law of Attraction, if you pay attention, and she repeats herself over and over again, I guess that you have to use repetition so that it sinks in. That yes, you're paying attention to the thoughts, but you're paying attention to what do these thoughts make you feel. So if what you're thinking is making you feel bad, you have to stop that and reorient your thinking to thinking that makes you feel good. And if what you're doing and what you're thinking makes you feel good, you're going in the right direction. So the key is right there in your feeling sense. And I think that's why all these DNA programs are there, trying to get what the humans have. The other thing that has been said, and we've mentioned it many times, and Andrew Bartz talks about this all the time, is that he says that just because you have a spaceship does not mean that you can visit any star out there in the universe. For a solar system to let you in to visit them, you have to have a specific set of codes. And Andrew Barr says that's why everybody out there wants these meat suits, because our DNA, as it exists, you can go anywhere in the universe. It has all the codes to all the star systems. And that's why they want it so bad. And that's why they want to splice it into their own DNA, because it opens the door to the universe. It doesn't matter if your civilization is 1 million years old. If you're missing the codes, you're not getting there. Because these guys that have the technology, have you seen those NASA videos where they can actually capture these giant spheres and they flash in and out and they go into the sun and they come out of the sun? Have you seen those? I've seen them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these things have been going for years and years. I've been watching the sun ever since about 1998. Yeah. I've been watching the sun and these things popping in and out, yeah.
Bartz explains about that. He says that the civilizations that have the necessary technology, they use stars as wormholes, because the sun will connect to other stars. As long as you have the DNA code that will let you go to that other star that you want to go to. If you don't have the code, you're not going there. So you would have to go the slow way, travel through space, which is...
Can I jump in here for a second? Because, please. Jay, we were on with Tolpec, and I was explaining what Walt just explained about how human beings have all this DNA that allows them to go every place. And do you remember he was like, oh, wow. And I don't think he ever said it aloud before, at least I've never heard it. But he said, that's why the ETs think of human beings as royalty. Remember that?
Yes, and this is something that Alex Collier has said. Same thing. We've got all the codes here, but we're like stupefied so that we don't realize that we can drive. We got a universal driving license and a universal day pass to go anywhere we like, because so many people have messed about with us. They've left their DNA, therefore their codes, in us. So it's basically karma for all the rest of the raping, pillaging races of the world that we're coming back. It's like, actually, you know what it's like? It's like England invading India and colonizing India and then complaining when the Indians come back to England.
Walt, explain or tell the story about Anelia when she had that thing about the... who was it that was supposed to be the Sumerians? The Sumerians. Who was it? The Archons? Not the Archons.
What do you mean, the Anunnaki?
Anunnaki. How she found that tape that she had made when, and she didn't even remember it, but she had made
a recording, and she had she wasn't even aware that she had made it. She was just scanning through saved recordings on her phone, because sometimes she'll do that. She'll hit the record, and then she has no notion what was it that was recorded. And she was saying that they were coming back, because when they did what they did, their DNA manipulation, for them, it was a physical change. It was something they did at the material 3D level. They did the changes to the DNA to create a slave work race, you know, slave labor. But in doing that, they did not take into account that DNA is multidimensional, and it extends out from the material into the spiritual. And the changes they had made were, they thought that they were safe, you know, we've done this to these people, we're okay. They were literally affecting themselves.
I just had to plug in I realized I was not using
the... Oh, that's better, Walt.
Correct microphone, sorry about that.
That's better. Yeah, it sounds a lot better. There's no background hum or anything now.
Okay.
So, yeah, so basically by raping and pillaging the humans, they quantum entangled their own stuff with us. And so we've got all the benefit of their stuff.
And the thing that also captured in the recording is that it's actually scaring them, because people are waking up. It seems that their status quo has been going on for thousands of years. Everybody's okay. We don't need any change. But like I said before, you know, change the trajectory through the dimensions is a spiral like a spring, and you can only squeeze a spring for so long before it has to, you know, spring out. It, all that energy has to be released. And these people have been the same thing for millennia. And guess what? You know, evolution is knocking on their door. And they're kind of creeped out about it because their population is waking up to potentials they weren't aware existed. And they don't know how to deal with it because they never dealt with it. They've been happy being as they are. So at the end of the, I think Nancy might remember, at the end of the recording, the last few words was that they're coming back. But I don't know how to interpret that, if they're coming back physically or spiritually, or those people that are saying, oh yeah, look, there's pictures of Nibiru and NASA is lying, and I don't know.
I think it came down. To the fact that they didn't know how to deal with it, because the DNA, mm-hmm. as we are awakening, that DNA message is being sent to their home planet, and so their people are awakening. So the concept being, well, maybe we better go back and eradicate the human DNA on Earth now, because it's my opinion that the traditional flood story was really their way of trying to eradicate the DNA. On the Earth, so that they just, you know, the experiment was over, let's get out of here and let's get rid of all the trace that we were here. But obviously somebody decided that they would tell Noah about the Ark. So there was a problem. So I think that's what she was, you know, sort of alluding to, was that, that some of them have come back to try to figure this out. But I also think that, if I remember correctly, she sort of left it like, there was also this feeling that they can't do anything about it, because they can't, you know, it's too late. It's too late in the game. That's at least what I took away from it.
Yeah. And then you see the other part. He spoke about it the last time that he was online with JP. Simon Parks said how the reptilians are... throughout the galaxy, they're known as experts in DNA manipulation. In fact, it's something that they trade on. Yet, for all their expertise, they're still ignorant of higher dimensional DNA, how it impacts the other dimensions. Because since they don't have a feeling sense and they don't have emotions, they're like an evolutionary dead end. I mean, they got this far, and this is it. Whatever you are right now, that is the highest expression that you're going to get out of your life forms. And they're not looking to evolve because they see themselves at the top of the pyramid. I mean, we are the highest expression of our evolution, so why should we bother? And that's why humans to them are an annoyance. It's annoying to them that a non-reptilian can be so advanced and so full of psychic abilities and capabilities and whatnot.
Yeah, it really pisses them off, and I like that. So here's the thing. You know, we've got the black stones, we got the black goos, we got the reptilians, and we've got the implants, back of the neck, which, you know, I've had a terrible couple of weeks with the back of my neck. I don't know if anybody else has had it. Or in fact, all down my spine. I've kind of cricked another bit down my spine as well. So I don't know what's going on, but it feels like I'm having some sort of osteopathic fit with what's going on in my body. But I don't know what's going on for anybody else. Are you getting that, Walt or Nancy? Like bones crunching away.
Oh, well, I don't know. What everybody's experiencing some kind of adjustment. I know that I have. I mean, one day you'll have some kind of muscular pain, and then the next day there's nothing there, like you didn't have it. So the other thing that tells me that it's all energy and nothing physical is that when you have some kind of pain condition and it's non-reactive to painkillers, you take something that for the pain, an analgesic or something, and it has no effect whatsoever. To me, that's a dead giveaway that what you're experiencing has nothing, it's nothing physical at all.
Interesting. Nancy, how
you know,
are you?
Jay, well, no, I haven't really had, no, But we have shungite magnet bracelets now, so.
Plus Nancy has the Rolls Royce of humans.
Yeah, and the Rolls Royce of humans. you know, Walt and I, he's a shamanic journeyer, and I do remote viewing. In both cases, you have to deal with the etheric world. Some people think in terms of astral projecting, well, that's the etheric world. People that are on hallucinogenics, well, you're in the etheric world. It's a very real place, it's just that most people don't go there and most people don't feel comfortable there. Well, luckily, Walt does, and luckily, I do. And so, we've gone on some very mystical kind of trips that are honestly just etheric traveling, and using our ability to conceive of solutions, because it really is all storytelling. All of reality is just one illusion after the other, but if you're telling the best story, well, you're going to get the more people listening to you. So we have these stories that we get involved in, and one of them dealt with a black goo. Now, there's two types of black goo. There's black goo that is the oil that they can get from the underside of right deep well drilling is trying to get to this aortic oil that's there, that, you know, but it's part of what Walt thinks is like the lymphatic system of Earth. The way he saw it in a shamanic journey, that's what he saw, was that it's a functioning aspect of keeping Gaia very healthy is not to drill that oil. That's dangerous. It's bad. So even though the oil is there, it's a good oil. It needs to be there. But then there's this other black oil. And it was the black oil that I just told the story on Mona's show the other day, but it was the black oil that caused the Falkland War. You know the story, Jay.
Yeah.
And that the black goo was under Thule Island in the Falklands. And there was a group of ETs, which Barbara Threecrow made us wonder if it wasn't the group that is actually part of the Inner Earth City. And so when we were in the, you know, looking at all of this, the British managed to get some of it and sent it back to Marconi Electronics in Britain, and then all these people died, and I mean, it was one story after another. It was an amazing journey, but we ended up sending that black goo back to from whence it came, because one of the things that we can do is that if there's anything on this planet that is artificial, that is not created by Mother, by Gaia, then we can do something about it. There are certain things that we can't touch because it's part and parcel of who she is, even if we think it, you know, we tried to get rid of the fleas and chicks, but that became problematic. Any long story. So we can't do everything. But if it's not supposed to be here, then we have the right as humanity for Walt and I in the audience that we have to stand up and say, no, we're going to do something with you because you're not supposed to be here anyway. So this black goo that was, you know, involved with the Falkland Wars and was under the Arctic and keeping cold, was really something that was, once it turned on, by a certain frequency, it would begin terraforming. It would change the first face of the Earth completely. So we decided, okay, let's just send this back. Let's find out where we're going. And it ended up going through a portal that is the portal over Atlantis, right off the coast of where I lived here in South Florida. And what happened was I was remote viewing. I was watching the whole thing. And Walt was kind of talking through the, you know, what are we doing here? And, you know, we would discuss every aspect of what we could think could possibly go wrong, or are we doing it for positive purposes? We're not, you know, it's a love thing. And I basically said to this black goo, I said, what do you want? You know, because again, it's a sentient being. It may be artificially sentient, but it's still a sentient being. So I said, what do you want? What do you want us to do here? And the response was, wasn't it, die? I said, whoa, die, you know? So then we discussed, okay, so what does this mean, die? Well, it means die in this reality, you know? And so we decided, and we asked Gaia, and we got permission to be able to send it back through the portal to where it started, You're just going back to your source, even though it's an artificial source. And so as the portal opened up and this black goo began to just go through it, I suddenly was surrounded by screams. I could hear screaming. And because I started focusing on the screaming as a remote viewer, I was emotionally drawn to where that screaming was. So then all of a sudden I'm off planet and I'm in a laboratory, a big kind of laboratory, and there were human looking characters that were absolutely screaming and going through this complex, oh my God, what's happened? What's happened? Something's going wrong. Because what had happened is that we went back, when we sent them back, it went back to the time that they were sent. It was sent to Earth, where it was being created. So when this stuff ended up back in the vat that it had come from, it completely polluted the stuff that was already there, and essentially, it attacked everything. It did its job, but it did its job back there. And the other thing that was happening while all this was occurring was I kept seeing swastikas. You know, and my take on it was that this was a Nazi operation. It was like the fail-safe. You know, if everything else fails, then we're just going to terraform the whole place and start from zilch. And the black goo itself did not want that mission. A lot of these things that seem to be weaponized AIs, they interestingly do not have a concept of self-preservation in my reading of them. It's more of a, I don't want to do bad. You know, it's like a dog. A dog does not want to do bad. The only reason you get a bad dog is because they don't know what good is. And that's the feeling that I get in the infrequent excursions I've had into this this strange world.
So this is go ahead.
No, that's it.
So this is very connected with that story that you told about when you first were given that artifact. When was it? In the 70s, and you went to remote view it, and you were flooded with these emotions and. Which, what was obviously, you tripped a psychic program that sent all this negative emotion to you, plus this whole scary swastika thing.
Well, I think it actually is live people. I mean, I think it's psychics. They may have some kind of an automatic thing. But when I went back there, yes, I was given a picture of something that our remote viewing people over here couldn't get through to see. They didn't tell me why. They just asked me to do it. So when I did it, the first thing that happens was those swastika things. And then this tremendous amount of fear, absolute fear. And I felt at the time that there were actually live psychics sitting there waiting for signals like mine to try to intrude. And then after I explained what happened, they said, yes, that's what all their deep remote viewers were getting. The same thing. So when I felt the same thing at the time we were doing the black goo, there were not human beings sitting there trying to jam me, because they had no idea that somebody would come through like that. But it was the essence of these people themselves. I was remote viewing the Nazi energy. You know,
So slightly.
Say again?
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. So it was slightly...
So it was slightly different. In other words, it was similarity in the SWAT stickers, but the first one back in the 70s, it was because somebody was trying to jam me. Another psychic was... Actually, there was more than three trying to jam me. But there, it was just that the people there were Nazis. You know? I mean, they were... They were Nazis. That's all I can say.
Yeah. So, what we might be looking at is the energy that is, you know, we all know, you know, that the Nazis are evil. But why are they evil? How come they're so evil? How come they lose their heart? Are they possessed by something? And that's what it seems to be. It seems to be that this stuff is like a demonic possession, is probably what is a demonic possession. So when you say that you've sent that black goo back, does that mean that, you know, because it seems that all the black goos have to have some controlling intelligence that is like the programmer of it. It doesn't seem to have its own malign intent. It is just neutral, is it not? I don't know. Am I right? Or is it, you know, because what, you know, in the Andronicus story, the guy who found it discovered that it could do, you know, it could do what he wanted it to do, but his intent was malign.
No, you made me think of a question now. You heard all those writers and investigators in the UFO community. I have read some postings and articles, and there are writers that they do accept that there are different grades and flavors of gray. You know, they vary in color, they vary in size.
Yeah, 50 Shades of Grey. Sorry, I had to do that.
Yeah, some are Zetas and others are Reticulans. But among these groups of grays, several writers agree that there's one that's actually not from another planet, but they claim that they're actually an evolution of humanity, that they're from the future. And they reached an evolutionary impasse because they can no longer reproduce organically. I mean, they're cloning themselves.
I think that's humanity 2.0.
Well, that the connection that I see is that Andrumbala Melchizedek speaks of this, that he says that the reason these grays reached that evolutionary impasse is because they eliminated or neutralized their own emotional body, because they figured that they could, you know, go through all the dimensions through pure intellect, and then they reach this door that they can't pass, so they have to reach back into the past. They were the motivating force behind the hybridization process, so they can get back the emotional body. Now this makes me think, could these be the future Nazis?
It could well be that these are the people who the Nazis evolve into. Here's a little interesting thing. I had a journey a few months back.
Wait a minute. Just before.
Go. All right. Sorry. Go on.
No. Let's think on that. That is an amazing thought.
This is connected, though. Come.
Go ahead. Well, I just love this talk.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, I did a kind of practice ET contact, but it seemed to be a little more than that. But anyway, I spoke to went up to a little grey, ship landed, spoke to a little grey. And the emotion that I got for him was like, oh, I'm really sorry. You know, I'm really sorry that happened to you, because, you know, that could have been avoided, and I'm really sorry. And I kind of essentially said goodbye to them. And as you're saying this, that just so links in with what we're saying, is that they're now, you know, that timeline can be reduced and eliminated, and eventually that will be like a kind of, you know, maybe a museum piece somewhere on some psychic level, but that timeline won't exist anymore, where these beings tried to eliminate their... I also thought of Gollum. Isn't that what, you know, Gollum is what they call regressive. That's right. He regresses into this kind of gnarly little creature. And he looks like a grey, doesn't he? Looks a bit like a grey.
Isn't it interesting why he regressed?
Yeah, why did he regress?
Because instead of owning the power of the ring owned him.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a... like a morality play. This is what happens if you're not ready to handle power beyond your understanding and grasp. It reduces you to your lowest level, your lowest denominator.
Isn't it interesting that a gold ring is, you know, we were talking about gold before, and, you know, Nikki and I have been, I bought some gold leaf recently, and I put some on a piece of chocolate last night and cut it up into a pieces, and we shared it and sort of allowed the gold to infuse in our bodies. It is quite interesting, this the energy of gold, you know, just like eating a bit of gold leaf is really quite cool, I have to say. recommended. You get some gold into your body and
well, you can. I make monatomic gold with the pyramid. Did you know that gold dissolves inside a pyramid?
Gold dissolves inside a pyramid.
Yep, that's how you get monatomic. I use vodka to capture it. I got 24 karat gold leaf from an eBay vendor from Thailand.
Okay.
And you put several leaves inside a little dropper bottle and you fill it with the vodka and you put it inside a pyramid. It can be solid pyramid or a frame pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Just you make sure that you look for that sweet spot, which is like one third from the base.
Oh, the King's Chamber position, yeah. How much vodka?
A little dropper bottle, you know, like an eyedropper.
All right.
And as the days progress, you can check it every day if you want. As the days progress, the particles get smaller and smaller and smaller until it looks like there's just a little bit of sand inside the liquid because the gold has dissolved completely. And the color of the vodka is now amber, yellow, and it's now sweet. Mm. You know that vodka doesn't have any...
Mm.
It's as alcohol. It doesn't have any sweetness to it. When the gold dissolves in it, it becomes sweet.
Oh.
And just put a drop on your tongue and then your head explodes and it feels like it's 6 feet in diameter and you get to experience all kind of weird stuff.
Sounds like amyl nitrate.
when can we put this in the store?
Oh, yeah. This sounds like good stuff, and it sounds like I can do it, because A, I have gold leaf, B, I have alcohol, and C, I have pyramids, so, we might see some of that, and,
I use my dowsing with the pendulum,
mm-hmm.
and you know where the word comes from, pyramid, it means fire in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So that value that I doused for this, that value of one third from the base actually puts you at the base of the flame. So I doused how much high would I be to be at the peak of the flame.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did that, when I moved the bottle a little bit higher,
mm-hmm.
then it dissolved faster.
All right.
So it's a little bit above one third. And if you have a pendulum, you can douse for the sweet spot.
Okay. Let's go from there to pyramids, right? In our discussion last night, I had the most amazing insight. So, get this. The pyramid used to be wrapped around with a coil of gold rope, of gold cable. Right? And the marks are still there. And that's why they chipped away the limestone to get at this gold cable, wherever it might be, right? Now, there have been mysterious chambers, shafts, they call them. You know about these shafts, they call them, one goes to Sirius, and they call them ventilation shafts.
You didn't know that they used the pyramid to modify weather, though, right?
Yeah, well, hang on a second, Walt. You know they had these shafts? Yeah?
Yeah.
So when they send a little robot up the shaft, you know what they see?
Hmm. What do they see?
They see two copper fittings. Now, to any electrician, you'd say, oh, those are terminal blocks. You know, that's a terminal.
Mm-hmm.
So the cable used to go down into the chamber where the pyramid was generating energy, and these mysterious shafts, they carry the cable down from the outside.
Yeah, they used to shoot ion streams out of those openings. Did you ever read that book by Elizabeth Heisch, the German lady?
No.
Initiation?
Uh-huh.
Where she retells the story when she lived in that time.
Mm-hmm. What did she say?
And she tells how they never had issues with their agriculture because they used the pyramid to control the precipitation.
It's a huge coil.
Pointing in the four directions.
It's a Tesla coil.
If they wanted rain in a specific area, they would shoot ionizing beams from the shafts, and then clouds would form over that area, and you would get rainfall. So they had no... They used the pyramid among the many functions. It was used for weather modification.
So there you go. So we got
wouldn't that make sense if you got, I'm assuming what you're saying, Jay, is that they've got the cable wrapped around the outside of the pyramid,
yeah,
and that the ends of the cables are coming back down those open shafts,
yes,
into the interior of the cable of the pyramid, where the energy is then, the cables are then attached to the energy developing inside it.
That's right.
And if you had that kind of a structure, I would assume that inside that containment of the shaft itself, that you probably would create an ion beam.
Now, here's the thing.
Just by the way that the whole thing was working.
Yes. Now, right. Now, here's my thought, right? One of the thoughts that I've had is, like, the pyramid, very, very long time ago, was used to create the firmament. And it did this because here's one thing you said, and something that everybody says about pyramids is that they desiccate, which means that they remove water from, they dry up, they mummify. And so my thought comes up to this, and it's like, oh, well, that means that what the pyramid does is turn water into plasma. And what else into plasma? And it looks like it also turns gold into plasma, doesn't it, Walt?
Well, wasn't there at the bottom of the pyramid, wasn't there a pool of water?
Yes. So I believe that what the original purpose of it was to have, there's a big pump in it, there's a massive hydraulic pump, and there's a plasma chamber that, and there's no roof, right? Or there's a roof, but, you know, that it basically turns water into plasma, into energy, sends it in the coil and whoop, and sends it up into the atmosphere to then reform as ice crystals that then form a coating like the shell of a tortoise, a turtle.
Well, water is the number one argon storage medium. That's why you see pictures of UFOs hovering over lakes, and you see little spikes in the water like they're pulling something invisible out of the water, because water is the number one storage medium for argon. It's able to contain tremendous volumes, so that would be ideal. In one of the two volume books, Flower of Life by Drumbala Melchizedek, once he visited the different pyramids in Egypt, he says there's one that they went to visit. In order for them to be able to go inside and visit the chambers, they have to get somebody to bring in an electric pump and actually pump it out, because it's constantly filled with water. Because he says a pyramid properly constructed with the proper proportions actually pulls water out of the ground. So they have to get someone to pump this. I don't know how long it takes. And then the water level drops enough for them to step in and kind of see the chambers. But then the next day you come back and the level is already almost to the top. So in ancient times, they must have used that for irrigation purposes.
Well, it looks like the ability to teleport or beam or de-res water into plasma to be placed wherever to make clouds, to irrigate, yes, to transport human souls, perhaps, you know, the pyramid is also used as a teleporter when the time's right. So maybe there are times when there's plenty of water and it pumps it up and it's, and at other times you're doing other things. It's doing like teleports and stuff. I don't know which one comes first, because, you know, we're talking. Colleen's now saying, so you're saying God had to have a golden filigree roped wrapped pyramid to create the firmament. Yes, Tesla is God. It's a Tesla coil, isn't it? And I don't, you see, I'm just coming, this is, I'm just pulling this straight out of my head, right? But I'm sure it just feels so right that all the things that, all the different, what Wilcott calls data points, they all fit. Because they say there used to be a firmament, which is an ice shield, right? Now, how do you make an ice shield? Well, you deposit it drop by drop by remote control. You send plasma to reform as ice, You know, because plasma is a form of ice. It's just very, very loosely arranged molecules, which can be sent along an energy beam. Maybe a 27 kilohertz. You know, go on.
If you send that water, that plasma up into orbit, given the absence of atmospheric pressure, it'll instantly, you'll get instant crystals, like those Emoto crystals.
Exactly.
So you have the planet surrounded by a shield of snowflakes.
Exactly. And that, I believe, if that happens all over the world, that it will create little patches, little round, you know, patches that will eventually meet up and hook together like a turtle. I'm trying to say tortoise. Yeah, we say tortoise, you say turtle. Okay, like a turtle shell. You see? You see what I'm saying?
I thought the difference. Sorry for the question. Isn't the difference between tortoise and turtle that it's the gender? The female, like duck and drake, is the gender.
I'm not sure. I mean, for me,
male.
A tortoise
is a land.
It's a land one, and a turtle is a sea one.
And a turtle is a water.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
Yes. The selfish rooster came first. Well done, Doc, for solving that ancient mystery. Oh, we're solving some mysteries tonight, including the chicken and egg. Actually, my solution is that it doesn't necessarily take a chicken to lay an egg. There's something that might have been not quite a chicken that laid an egg that then became a chicken. Or it was genetically engineered in a laboratory and we don't have to worry about these stupid philosophical questions. It's just a corporate matter. You know, it's the product. Oh, my God. We saw the film The Island. Have you seen The Island?
New film?
2005, 10 years old. Actually talking about 2015, and yes.
Oh, you mean the one where they had all these guys were clones of people that were alive?
Yes. Yes.
And he's trying to find his source of his...
That's
the,
right.
The person that actually gave origin to him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
That was a remake of a film that was done in the 70s.
Is it? What was that film called?
I don't remember if it was The Island. I do remember the character finding the person that was the source of his DNA, and the man was able to confirm that, you are obviously my clone. They both have the same birthmark. And this man, supposedly, the man was, I think, a world-known scientist or something, but what he ended up discovering is that they were cloning all these very important people, like politicians and scientists and whatnot. So if, for example, at any one time, somebody very wealthy, like, you know, some Rothschild or something needs a heart transplant or something.
That's right. They sacrifice.
There you have it. An instant donor, 100% compatible because it's a clone of you.
That's right. Yeah, it's a really creepy movie because it's like all very, very, very kind of possible. Anyway, we're out of time. We've got to go over to the Earth Healers group just now, and hopefully it'll have less of a doomy, gloomy, Nazi-oriented thing, maybe something a little more positive. But I hope, I hope by scraping through this little barrel load, we've found a few nuggets down there, and then we can put the whole thing on the fire and let it all go. By the way, tonight I've started my first... studio-based fire here. I have a stove in the studio. I've just started it up for the first time this winter, so that's all good. Anyhow,
okay.
Thank you very much. Nancy.
And Walt and I are on Tuesdays at 7 Eastern Time, 4 PST time, and we will talk more about all this really good stuff. Hey, you should come on with us some night.
If I'm in on a Tuesday, you have to sort of kidnap Nikki or something.
That. Yeah. I know that.
All right. Night, everybody. Thank you so much, Walt. Thank you, Nancy.
Good night, Nancy. Good night, JP. Thank you for having me.
Good night. God bless you.
Bye.
Beyond.